This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us this June day. Today, we're going to start our show talking with Sandy Thompson. She has a master's in management, and she is a licensed addiction counselor, but more specifically, she provides family recovery coaching. And this is something that is useful, obviously, to people who are going through an addiction process and or have a family issue that requires her assistance. But I'm going to get some background here with you. So, Sandy, welcome, first of all.
Thanks for having me, and happy first day of summer.
There we go. Yes, that longest day is upon us here. Sandy joins us from our Bismarck studio, and Sandy is the CEO and owner of a company in Bismarck, Mandan, called Path to Pono. That's P-O-N-O. Sandy, give us a brief description of your background and your training.
Well, as you started out, I am a licensed addiction counselor in North Dakota, and I have been since 1991. I received my bachelor's degree from Minot State University, and I worked as an addiction counselor for many years. And in the early 2000s, I went back and got my master's in management. And over the years, I've worked in inpatient, outpatient, residential treatment for substance use. And I've been a counselor, a supervisor, and a director of agencies.
How do you become a licensed addiction counselor?
Well, currently the process is a minimum of a bachelor's degree in a social science, criminal justice or addiction studies, social work, some of those kinds of majors. And then you are also required to do a clinical practicum, which currently stands at 1,400 hours post-coursework.
Does North Dakota have enough licensed addiction counselors?
No, we never have. There is a shortage, especially like in rural areas. There certainly is not enough addiction services being provided to our rural families.
Why is your counseling business called Path to Pono?
You know, in January of 2017, after having worked for others for all of my career, I decided that I wanted to venture out and do something on my own. And I had a long period of time where I thought about, you know, what are my passions? And my passions are addiction, and especially families of addicted family members. And the other passion is leadership and supervision and effective recruitment and retention strategies in the workforce. And I decided that that is what I was going to pursue and work for myself. And where the title comes from, I know Pono is a very unique name in North Dakota, but Pono is a Hawaiian word that stands, or it is translated to mean serenity, living your life right, having morals, having integrity, honest, basically what we're all striving for every day. I mean, isn't what we all want is to be happy in our personal lives and our work lives? And I've been fortunate enough to travel to the Hawaiian Islands and was able to talk to Native Hawaiians and have had many conversations about what Pono means. And it's a journey and it's a path. And we're all growing, we're all learning. And I really thought that that title really embodied what I stood for and what I was wanting to do.
Well, let's talk specifically about this one area that you handle, that is family recovery coaching.
Yes.
Describe it.
Recovery coaching in and of itself is not a new concept, but it's newer to North Dakota. And back in 2011, 2012, I was lucky enough to be trained as a recovery coach in Connecticut at an agency called the Connecticut Community of Addiction Recovery, or CCAR. It was a week-long training, and recovery coaching is for those that are in recovery from their substance use, and they need some mentorship in the community. So it's not treatment. It's not going to a 12-step fellowship program. It's not a pastor. It's not a counselor. It's a mentor. And when I thought about what I wanted to pursue for my own business as family recovery coaching, what I do is that I specifically work with those that are family members of those that are struggling with their substance use, and I mentor family members that are seeking to decrease the impact of addiction on their own personal lives.
And what are the effects of addiction to those closely related? I mean, what's the collateral damage here?
Interesting choice of words. The collateral damage is the family members are watching what's happening as the addiction gets stronger and creates more damage or more havoc with their personal lives. It is impacting the family members. So family members are watching this happen. They're watching an increase in use. They're watching the financial problems. They're watching the legal problems happen. They're watching relationships fall apart. They're watching their own relationship with their loved one fall apart because of the substance use. So trust, respect, admiration, I mean, just all of those things are impacted, along with, let's say it's a spousal relationship or a partner relationship. There's potentially financial implications, legal implications. There's no part of a person's life that is using excessively that isn't impacted when there's a substance use problem. And therefore, if I'm a family member and I care for this individual, most likely all of my life areas are going to be impacted as well.
Well, let's talk about the effect on kids, the youngest members of a family.
Mm-hmm. You know, small children, while they may not have the vocabulary that you and I would to be able to describe what they're experiencing, they're most likely going to exhibit that in their behavior. So if there is a family unit where one of the parents is using excessively and there's a lot of tension in the home, there's financial problems because of the substance use, or there's relationship problems, the younger kids are mostly going to exhibit that through their behavior. So they might have more meltdowns, or they may have more behavioral problems and, you know, not listening to directives or following house rules. Middle school age, they're probably going to see an increase in maybe some defiance, more so than the little ones. Because they are going to kind of know what's going on. I mean, they have enough in their brain development, and they can observe enough that they can put two and two together that, you know, it's because of the substance use that this is all going on. And a lot of times that might lead to some kind of social services involvement.
Well, you mentioned that North Dakota doesn't have enough licensed addiction counselors, and you are pretty unique being a family recovery coach in the state. When most addicted people have some sort of family connection, you would think that there would be a big demand for this. How do families come to you?
You know, mostly by word of mouth. And, you know, a lot of family members call. Not so. It's interesting. Family members will call not so much to get help for themselves, but to get help for their loved one. And when I clarify for them that, you know, I'm really here for you. I'm here for you as a family member to help you you know, decrease the impact of that addiction on your life. It's almost like it's the first time they're like, oh, yeah, wait a minute. And I often call the family members the forgotten victims of addiction. You know, we all know people in our family or our community or in our professions. We all know people who have struggled, either are currently struggling or have in the past. And I think it's great that, you know, our state highlights the need for addiction treatment. But I'm here to say that family members need just as much help.
Well, a lot of these addiction programs have a component in them where the addicted person has a step where they apologize, if you will, to mm-hmm. family members. They might write a letter or something and go in great detail about what they believe they did and why they regret it and that kind of thing. Is family recovery coaching sort of an extension of that, or how would you describe the difference there?
How I would describe it differently is that I work exclusively with the family members, and that depending on where they're at, I may meet with them in person. I may meet with them using technology like Skype or Zoom or through a private Facebook group, or it could be a telephone. If somebody's not tech savvy, then, you know, we would have our meeting times via the phone. So it's really convenient for those that are more rural and don't have access to a treatment center. You know, a lot of times family members can't really get services specifically like this unless their family member is in a treatment center. And that's hard to do. It's hard to get your loved one to come to the realization that they maybe need treatment. So it doesn't matter for the service that I provide. It doesn't matter if your person is in treatment or not. I'm here to work with that individual to take a look at all of the parts of their life that are being impacted by another's addiction and help them prioritize where do you want to start? Where is it that you want to attempt to do something different so that the other person's addiction is not impacting your life to the degree that it is?
Well, oftentimes these issues, these addictive issues, can result in the dissolution of a family, or at least temporarily. Kids go into foster care, for example. And a week ago today was National Foster Parent Appreciation Day, and we were kind of looking at some stats back that Thursday. And in North Dakota, the number of kids in foster care is up 35% since 2011. And 85% of these kids are in family homes. Do you also, provide recovery coaching to foster families?
Well, I have presented some education at a recent training of foster care parents in North Dakota. And there, what I talked about was looking not only for signs and symptoms of adolescent substance use, maybe, you know, the foster children that come into their home, you know, what could they be as a foster parent? What could they be looking for as signs of substance use? But I also talked with the foster parents about family recovery coaching in terms of for them personally, or if they have a young child in their home or a teenager, older teenager, who is in or has been involved in addiction treatment, you know, just some things that they can do to lessen the impact of that addiction on their life or on their family. Did that answer your question?
Well, what I'm getting at also is that when you take a child out of the family home and put them in a foster home, or as is happening on the southern border, in some sort of a place where they're separated from their parents, what happens to that kid?
You know, in the 25 plus years that I've been in the behavior health world, I've worked with a lot of foster children, a lot of foster families, and with a lot of families that have had their children placed in foster care, and all related to substance use is where my background would be. And regardless of the reason, whether it's, you know, some kind of positive reason or something traumatic, like they've been removed as a result of being placed in foster care, there's no doubt that regardless of the age, that is a traumatic event for a child. It's life-changing. I mean, it does it is a memorable event in their childhood. When they look back on their childhood, there's no way that they won't remember being placed in foster care. That's not to say that foster care is bad, but obviously there were things going on in their family home that led to it being believed that they'd be safer elsewhere. And so they not only have the memories of whatever led up to being placed, but they also have the memory of being separated.
Well, this memory of being separated can be exacerbated if you're not sure you'll ever see that parent again either. So, and I think, not to put you in a difficult spot here, but we've got this issue going on in our southern border where we've had children separated from their parents for a legal purpose. Their parents were accused of a crime, illegally entering the country. The law said the children had to be put someplace else. Now there's an executive order saying the families can be together. But in the meantime, we've had thousands of kids separated from their parents, and there is some uncertainty about how and when they will get back together, which might not be the case in a foster environment.
You know, in my experience of working with foster children and foster families and families who have had their children removed and placed into foster care, you know, hats off to those that I have worked with in child welfare. The ultimate goal is for kids to be living with their family of origin as long as it's safe. And that's the important piece to remember, is that kids should always, in my opinion, always live with their biological families as long as it's safe for them to be there.
Now, failure, recidivism among addicts is pretty common. So is there a way to characterize the success ratio of your treatment approach, that is your licensed addiction counselor approach and family recovery coaching, to families dealing with these issues? Are you more likely to be successful?
Well, I would sure like to think so, but addiction is a disease, in my opinion, like any other. There are going to be times where a person's in remission, they're managing their illness, they're doing all of the things that they need to do to protect their sobriety, and they're following doctor's orders, so to speak. I mean, they're following what their counselor or their support groups have suggested to them. But bottom line, it comes down to personal choice. And so does relapse happen in addiction? Absolutely. Does it happen for everybody? No. I have a person in my own family who has been sober since December of 1999. And that individual, that was their one and only treatment. And to my knowledge, and I think it would be pretty obvious if this person did relapse in a large way, to my knowledge, that person has never relapsed, and that's amazing. But that's not the truth for everybody. I mean, look at anybody who has heart disease or diabetes or a seizure disorder. I mean, there are times where there are breakthroughs and there's relapses. And that happens when a person doesn't follow their prescription, so to speak. The same is true for family members. I'm a family member, and are there times that I may relapse in my thinking or in my behavior? Meaning, are there times where I might be a little more codependent than what's healthy for me? Of course I do.
All right. Well, Sandy Thompson is the CEO and owner of Path to Pono. You can find out more at Path to Pono. That's PathToPono.com. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Natural North Dakota is next.
to innovate, you must first start with an idea.
Anything is possible.
An engineering college in Lima designed a giant advertising billboard that absorbs air humidity and converts it into purified water.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour on NPR, and I'm inviting you to join me every Sunday here on Prairie Public.
In Silicon Valley, no one even takes you seriously unless you've had two failed startups. In other words, we're raising our girls to be perfect, and we're raising our boys to be brave.
Every week, we pick a theme, and we interview some of the greatest inventors, thinkers, writers, and artists from around the world.
If you analyze the skull and crossbones and Blackbeard's other design strategies like that, it's clear he was a very, very smart designer indeed.
People who've given TED Talks on technology, entertainment, and design.
If we start now, we can be ready for the next epidemic.
We examine fresh approaches to new problems, and we explore astonishing ways of thinking. Gilligan's Island, apparently it's one long parable. That's the TED Radio Hour, every Sunday at noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain, on Prairie Public, with me, Guy Raz.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Natural North Dakota is the name for a series of essays about where we live. It's written and voiced by Chuck Lura, who teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau. And today, Chuck tells us about the prairie coneflower.
One of the most widely recognized prairie wildflowers is prairie coneflower, Retibida columnifera. Also known as long-headed coneflower and upright prairie coneflower, the species ranges over prairies from Canada to Mexico, particularly on well-drained soils. If it's not in flower in your area now, it will be soon. The flowering period generally runs from June through August here in North Dakota. Prairie coneflower is a member of the aster family. It generally grows from 1 to 3 feet tall from a stout taproot. Many members of the aster family, such as the sunflowers, produce a head with inconspicuous disc flowers in the center, with the ray flowers, which produce petal-like rays, on the periphery. In the genus Retibida, however, the disc flowers form a cylinder, and I probably should say column, up to around an inch and a half long, with the ray flowers at the base, which are yellow in this species. One terminal head per stem is the rule in Retibida. However, occasionally there are two or more stems growing out from the taproot. Prairie coneflower is a wildflower species commonly used in seed mixes for prairie restoration. It's also gaining popularity as an ornamental. It's showy, easy to grow, drought-tolerant, and has a long blooming time. Two forms of this species are often available through garden centers and the various seed sources. Most of what we see in the native prairie is the form that produces yellow ray flowers. But occasionally a prairie coneflower is observed with deep red ray flowers. That's the other form, and is often sold as a variety Mexican hat. Native American tribes used prairie coneflower for a variety of medical conditions, such as to treat stomach ache. It was also used to treat snake bite and exposure to poison ivy. A tea was made from the leaves as well. While on a prairie tour many years ago, I visited with a lady that grew up during World War II. She mentioned that as a child during the war, she and other children from her home area in north central South Dakota collected the mature heads of prairie coneflower to be used to the war effort as stuffing of soldiers' life jackets. I put a picture of prairie coneflower along with the text of this natural North Dakota. You can access it at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear about a new cable TV show that aims at a rural audience. Sue Balcom of Rootsellers Farm will talk about dairy, and Ashley Thornburg and I will share our What's Happening calendar of things to do. Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in favor of the state of South Dakota in a case over internet sales tax collections. On a 5-4 vote, justices overturned the rule that a state could only receive sales tax if an online retailer has a physical presence in that state. That was the ruling in the 1992 Quill versus North Dakota case. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Earlier this year, Attorney General Marty Jackley argued South Dakota's case before the Supreme Court.
One thing that I tried to do as Attorney General is I'm speaking to 9 justices in Washington, D.C. And what I needed to do is convey what this federal law is really doing to real people, the Main Street businesses, something that I see as Attorney General and hear as I talk to store clerks and small business owners across our state. And so what I talked to the justices about was from the heart of what this is really doing to our businesses, the harm that it's causing, and the fact that because there has been such a substantial change in technology, those concerns under that federal law back in 1992 don't exist as much as they used to.
The case was a challenge to a law passed by the South Dakota legislature in 2016. At that time, Governor Dennis Stuggard said the state was losing about $50 million a year in revenue due to online sales taxes. Purchasers are supposed to pay the tax on their own, but many have not. Legislators passed a law that posed as a direct challenge to the 1992 physical presence law. The state sued several online retailers, but officials conceded in court they could only win by getting the Supreme Court to overturn the earlier ruling. For Prairie Public, I'm Gary Ellenbolt in Vermilion, South Dakota.
The University of North Dakota and Ralph Engelstad Arena have inked a new three-year usage agreement. The deal runs retroactively from July 1st of 2017 to June 30th of 2020. The agreement serves as the operating outline between UND and the Ralph. General Manager Jody Hogson says there were a few tweaks, but the bulk of the agreement remains the same.
We've cleaned up some administrative and operational changes that have occurred over the last 18 months or so, but other than that, the terms in the new operating agreement are the same as the terms in the previous operating agreement.
The agreement has UND paying rent based on splits in ticket revenue and sponsorships. Hodgson says money retained by the REA pays for the building, capital improvements, and a reserve fund. The bulk of the balance is then returned to the university.
Each year it's a little bit different, and based on business and based on what kind of year we had and or what we project for the future, those numbers always change and are different every year. Our goal is to try and maximize the amount that we can allocate to UND Athletics at the end of each year.
Last year, the REA turned over about $750,000 to UND Athletics. The agreement contains no provisions or changes on use of the UND logo. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Kevin Costner returns to television tonight in the debut of the Paramount Network series Yellowstone. Costner plays a Montana rancher fighting to preserve his land and family. NPR TV critic Eric Deggan says the show is a sophisticated effort to create prestige television for rural America.
Yellowstone wastes no time in showing Kevin Costner's John Dutton as a rawhide, tough rancher who will do whatever it takes to solve a problem, including shooting a valued horse after it was severely injured in a collision with a land developer's truck.
Best I can offer you is peace.
That scene is more than a showcase for Dutton's strong will. It's a foreshadowing of all the threats he faces as owner of the largest contiguous cattle ranch in America. He's a widower with four adult kids. None has what it takes to succeed him, especially middle son Jamie, who's obsequious enough to suggest a compromise with a nearby town that wants to annex part of the ranch.
When you say no, it must be the death of the question.
I understand.
There's even a hint of maybe the questions won't stop until they find something you can't say no to.
There's a shifty developer who wants to gentrify the wide open spaces for his millionaire buddies, played by perennial heavy Danny Houston.
A friend of mine in Jackson Hole was talking about their rodeo. Bozeman doesn't have one. Why not?
Well, that's because nobody here cares about rodeos.
Oh, you're wrong, John. Every millionaire I know wants to be a cowboy. Authenticity is the one thing that money can't buy.
Well, parade in front of your friends, Dan, isn't an honor. It's an insult.
And there's a self-righteous Native American chief who wants to keep Dutton's cattle after they wander onto the reservation that he controls.
They don't belong to you. They don't belong to you either. Belong to the people now.
If you act like a thief, Thomas, I will treat you like one.
How can you stand there on a ranch the size of Rhode Island and accuse me of theft?
And that's where Yellowstone's story hits a huge snag, because Dutton's cowboy way of life is presented as a proud tradition stretching back six generations. But men like Dutton often amassed land and power by taking it from people who look like Chief Thomas Rainwater. Yellowstone positions Rainwater as a villain with sketchy methods, not so subtly encouraging viewers to side with Dutton. It's a missed opportunity for deeper drama. Written, directed, and produced by Oscar-nominated screenwriter Taylor Sheridan, Yellowstone is a lushly produced family drama. sort of like the prestige television version of Dallas. But Dutton doesn't have the maliciously fun appeal of a J.R. Ewing. In fact, few characters here are particularly likable or compelling. Dutton's daughter, Beth, for instance, is a walking cliché, a hard-drinking, damaged, and emasculating woman who acts like she stepped right out of a Saturday Night Live skit about strong, damaged female characters, especially during a meeting where she browbeats an oil company executive.
We don't want to merge.
No one wants to merge. You have a 3-to-1 debt ratio. It'd be easier to sell VCRs.
What do you think's gonna happen when I dump our 18% share tomorrow morning?
You will have the unique distinction of being the only drilling company to go bankrupt in the largest oil boom of the last century.
Yeah, that guy went along with what she wanted. It's strange to say this about the man who starred in Western classics like Dances with Wolves and Open Range, but Costner struggles to summon the weary grit of John Dutton. He's less authentic than you expect in a role he seems born to play. Though Dutton's character is flawed, Yellowstone clearly champions his values. It feels like an attempt to brand Paramount Network as a place for sophisticated stories about heroes in rural America. But Yellowstone would do better with a story that presents a more expansive, original vision of what makes an American hero. I'm Eric Deggans.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans from today's Morning Edition. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk about dairy with Sue Belcom.
You've heard of speed dating, right? Well, we have something akin to that. It's ASCA, Prairie Public's new initiative that aims to break down barriers and facilitate meaningful conversation and a deeper understanding. Here it is. Get 8 people from a group that's in the news and find 8 other sincerely curious folks who want to know more about them. We hope to spur lively one-on-one and group discussions and make connections with others in our communities. We'll interview participants for radio features that will be broadcast on Prairie Public so the conversations can have real statewide impact. Interested? We're looking for askers and answerers for our first ASCA chat, Ask a Native American, August 11th at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. You can sign up now or find out more at prairiepublic.org.
Support is provided by Cable One High-Speed Internet, designed to offer a streaming connection that allows customers to watch movies and videos without buffering or interruption. More information at 1-855-CABLE-1.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and in our Bismarck studio, Sue Belcom. She's with the Root Cellars Farm near Mandan.
Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here to talk to you about all kinds of fun food facts.
And we are well into the month of June, which is National Dairy Month. I've often made the joke that I am lactose super tolerant. So dairy is right up my alley here.
Boy, I don't know what I'd do if I couldn't eat dairy products. You know, there's so many of them. There's yogurt, and there's ice cream, and there's cottage cheese, and there's butter, and there's cream, and there's milk. And how could you, you know, what would you substitute for all those wonderful things?
Well, dairy is everywhere, but dairy farms aren't necessarily as prevalent as they used to be.
No, it's kind of a sad thing because as I was growing up, all my relatives milked cows, but today, according to the North Dakota Department of Agriculture website, there are only 91 dairy farms left in the state, and most of them are in Morton County.
Wow.
You know, and there used to be dairy farms everywhere. Even as early as 2000, the year 2000, there were 350 dairies in the state, so they've been on a sharp decline recently.
But I don't think dairy consumption is going down.
No, and I don't foresee that in the near future either, because milk is good for you, and June is National Dairy Month. So we're celebrating the farmers out there that are still willing to milk cows and provide that product to people. A long time ago, they wanted to promote drinking milk because apparently there was more of it than what we could manage to locally consume. Nowadays, you know, we have more trucks and it's easier to get it out into the general public outside the state. But yeah, it was pretty much developed as a way to stabilize the surplus milk that we were producing. And then after that, there was a National Dairy Council created, and we celebrate Dairy Month. In fact, Emmons County elects a dairy princess, I believe, still to this day. They had a celebration in early June. So,
well, Sue, you mentioned that you had this sort of dairy farming background in your family. And as it turns out, June, besides being National Dairy Month, is also Immigrant Heritage Month. And Immigrant Heritage is something Sue Balcom also celebrates, right?
That's right. For some reason, I became interested in local foods. And from there, I developed kind of a sense that I needed to know what my ancestors did. My great-grandparents immigrated over here. I'm probably a fourth-generation North Dakotan. They came over with the first wave of immigrants and helped settle the area down around Wishick, where I'm from. And, of course, everybody had dairy cows. So when I was interviewing some of my German-Russian relatives, they would talk about things like everybody that lived in the town still had access to fresh milk and cream because they used to have what was called a house cow. And Helen Frisch, I interviewed her. She's from Ashley. She was like 98 years old, and she was talking about how the cows were kept in a community pasture. So in the morning, she'd have to get up, walk over to this one empty block in this little town of Ashley, or Ventura, I think is where she was from, and she would milk the cow and take that home, and that's what the family would use. Then in the wintertime, of course, they couldn't leave those poor cows out there, so they usually brought them closer to home and put them in an outbuilding or a barn on their property.
Wow, a community pasture.
I know. It was really an interesting concept to me to hear that story. And then just the simple fact that even if you worked in town and you weren't a farmer, you still had access to milk, which was vital for kids to, you know, kids need to drink milk. It's full of all kinds of good nutrients. If you have osteoporosis, you know, or some other kind of thing, they're always after you to eat more products with calcium in, and that would be milk products.
Of course, cows have a certain schedule they like to follow, and that might affect other schedules, mightn't it?
Oh, definitely. So as you know, when a cow wants to be milked, they'll start a bellerin' because that's something that they don't like to have is full udders. So when we were growing up, I so distinctly remember that anything we had, gatherings, weddings, baptisms, whatever, you had to either plan them before milking or after milking. So if you wanted your party to end, you would plan before milking because you knew that everybody had to leave by 5 o'clock. One of the gals that I interviewed for the first project I did, Eva Gersatz, was Ellen Tuttle. And she was like 100 years old. And she talks about this very thing. So it was similar in all families of German-Russian descent.
Yeah, the 4th of July and Memorial Day and those were big days. Get up in the morning and milk the cows and get everything and get in the wagon with the horses and come to Linton and celebrate and then go home in time to milk again. And yeah,
gets to be a routine, doesn't it?
That is hilarious.
You have said a couple times milk is pretty good for us. What is in milk that is beneficial?
Well, milk contains, as I said before, calcium, also vitamin A, and that gives you healthy skin. But people who drink milk supposedly are able to keep their weight down also better than people who don't drink milk. But it has essential nutrients. It reduces your risk for high blood pressure and cancers again, of course. You can kind of see a correlation between good local food and diseases that we're experiencing now in this day and age. But it's also got protein in it. And, you know, if you're an active child, you need muscle tissue to grow. It's always being replaced, and milk is the best thing for you. But the best part, you guys, is the fact that they got to eat fresh cream and make ice cream with the products from their cows. So,
well, we'll talk about ice cream another time. Sue Balcom is with Rootsellers Farm near Mandan. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
Thank you.
My father believed any man that needed a vacation
should get a different job. For him, those 110 acres was the whole world. He needed nothing else.
Hi, this is Dave Isay, founder of the Public Radio Oral History Project StoryCorps. Remember an important person in your life when our mobile recording booth comes to town.
StoryCorps will be at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck, June 28th through July 27th. To make a reservation, go to prairiepublic.org or call 1-800-850-4406. Sponsored in part by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck.
Intelligence Squared U.S., where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues. The next topic up for debate is Bitcoin more than a bubble.
All the best engineers in the world are working on Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is the pets.com of the cryptocurrency world.
I'm John Donvan. Join me for a debate on the future of Bitcoin, the next Intelligence Squared U.S.
Don't miss Intelligence Squared U.S. This week's Prairie Public Presents coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Oh, yeah, that's the question. On the longest day of the year, of course, there's more time to burn, and Ashley Thornburg and I are looking at our What's Happening calendar of things to do, you know, to sort through the coming weekend.
There is a family board game creation and play day. This is happening on Saturday, June 23rd in Minot at the Public Library. Have you ever seen that board game? Oh, boy, I'm going to butcher this pronunciation. Nuftlof? I don't know how to say that. H-N-E-F-T-A-F-L?
Neftoffel?
Neftoffel? Yeah. Well, this is a game sort of like chess and checkers. And, you know, you are going to try to escape the king who's trying to get off the board. Well, you can learn all about this very complicated sounding game, just even starting with that spelling there. And you are able to make your own board for this game and then play it whenever you want. So do that Saturday, June 23rd in Minot at the Public Library from noon to 2, and it's free.
Yeah, Viking chess. Who knew? Winter Counts, a pictographic narrative of the American West, is Sunday in Washburn at the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center. If you've never been to this center, it is itself an attraction, so I urge you to check it out. You can meet Dakota Goodhouse and learn about Winter Counts, the Plains Indian record-keeping tradition that transcends written and oral history. Some Winter Counts document events going back hundreds of years. Others, like the ones Dakota will be bringing, are still being written today. Dakota Goodhouse will be at the Interpretive Center throughout most of the day. And it will have a scheduled talk at 2 p.m. That's Sunday, this coming Sunday, from 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon is the in total event, and then Dakota speaks at 2 o'clock. The cost is $7.50.
The 6th Annual Rhubarb Festival is this Sunday in Rugby at the Prairie Village Museum. This takes place annually on the last Sunday of June. That's right, June is already almost over. They are going to celebrate with a wine tasting from a local vineyard, a bake sale, musicians are going to be there, and of course, a whole host of rhubarb treats. The festival begins at noon and runs until 6 p.m., but they do caution you that treats and wine tend to run out pretty fast at this event, so show up on the early side of that if you can. Sunday the 24th in Rugby at the Prairie Village Museum. Tickets anywhere from free to $8.
The summer solstice sunset, that's today, Thursday, in Valley City at Medicine Wheel Park. If you want to take it in that environment, you can get connected to nature, get connected to the community, get connected to the universe. You can connect with friends and strangers for the summer solstice sunset at Valley City's Medicine Wheel Park. That's this evening at 9 p.m. Celebrate the longest day of the year. Sunset is at 9:30 p.m. And as the sky darkens, telescopes will be available to view Mercury, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, and the Moon. After midnight, Mars will join the show. So take in the summer solstice sunset at Valley City's Medicine Wheel Park. This evening, it starts at 9, and it's free.
Sabre Day 2018 this Sunday in Grand Forks at get this, the Grand Forks Ludosport Lightsaber Combat Academy at the Grand Cities Mall. This is a day where the community can come out about and to learn about the sport of lightsaber combat. You know you want to do this. There will be demonstrations, games, and introductory training for those just getting into lightsabering. 2 to 5 p.m. on Sunday in Grand Forks at the Grand Cities Mall. And it's free.
The Dickinson Youth Rodeo is Saturday in Dickinson at the Stark County Fairgrounds. Western fun for all ages. Kids ages 0 to 13. I think the zeros will probably just be watching. But they'll get to participate in events such as stick horse racing, dummy roping, goat tail untying, a flag race, sheep riding, barrels, poles, calf riding, steer riding, and breakaway roping. It starts at 9 o'clock at the Stark County Fairgrounds in Dickinson on Saturday morning. It's free.
I always cheer for the animals at those. Terry and Linda Schwartz will be in concert Saturday the 23rd in Jamestown at the Stutzman County Courthouse. This is a state historic site, by the way. They are going to be playing at 1 p.m. This is a Midwestern singing duo performing music and poetry at the Stutzman County Courthouse in Jamestown, and it's free.
A river paddling excursion and aviary expedition is next Wednesday in Moorhead at the Yemcombs Landing. Join them for the aviary expedition hosted by the Fargo-Moorhead Audubon Society. Learn about the distinct species of birds that live along the Red River and those that utilize it while migrating. All skill levels are invited. Each excursion begins at 6 p.m. with the basics of canoeing and kayaking, and please arrive at 5:30 p.m. Vessels are available on a first-come, first-served basis. The event was rescheduled from June 20th. So it's next Wednesday, the 27th at 5:30 in the afternoon. It's $10 per person if you bring a vessel, $15 a person for a canoe or kayak rentals, and ages 5 and under are free. What's
right,
your pick?
My pick of the week is an astronomy program tomorrow, Friday, June 22nd, in Glendive, Montana, at the Makoshika Amphitheater. This is a special look at the night sky with Dr. Corinne Brevik giving a short presentation about constellations, and then she'll kind of walk you through the viewing area, and you get to check out that beautiful night sky with telescopes. 9 o'clock on Friday, and of course that is a mountain time, and it's free.
Well, my pick is Guys and Dolls. It's tonight and Friday night in Moorhead at the MSU Moorhead Dill Center for the Arts. This is the Straw Hat Players musical, and it's an award-winning classical musical comedy that gambles with luck and love under the lights of Broadway. And of course, it was a big hit on Broadway when it debuted many years ago. It's set in Damon Runyon's mythical New York City. You join Nathan Detroit, his girlfriend Adelaide, Skye Masterson, and Sarah Brown as they ride the roller coaster of love and all that goes along with it. Lots of laughs in this show. 7:30 is the curtain. It costs $12 for students, seniors $22, and adults get in for $27. Guys and Dolls in Moorhead by the Straw Hat Players. That's what's happening.
To go out dancing. My baby loves a bunch of authors.
If your idea of a perfect Saturday night is curling up with
Short Works of Fiction,
then you'll want to cast your vote for the greatest book of all time.
It's PBS's The Great American Read.
Go to pbs.org/Great American Read and browse 100 of America's best loved novels.
Catcher in the Rye, Moby Dick, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Color Purple, The Great Gatsby, 50 Shades of Grey.
Wait, what?
My tastes are very singular.
Yeah, it's on there.
All right, and so is
vote for your favorite, then share your choice so your friends and family can join in.
Voting is open now till October 18th.
Then watch The Great American Read TV show, hosted by Meredith Vieira, starting in September. And America's choice for greatest novel will be revealed on the series finale.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 21st. On this date in 1916, Esther Marie Jack from Williams County made history. She was the first female to graduate from the University of North Dakota's College of Engineering. Esther was the daughter of Ida and Edwin Jack, a well-to-do farming couple near Buford. Esther was used to standing out, Born in 1894, she was one of the first white births in Williston and the only white girl in her school at Trenton for several years. She later went to school in Williston and was one of 19 students to graduate in 1912, the school's 10th graduating class. Once at UND, Esther was involved in a smattering of campus life events, participating in plays and taking on leadership roles. In her studies, she was singular as a woman. Reportedly, her male classmates in engineering did not welcome her, and at first, many tried to push her out. However, she eventually won them over, and they became quite fond of her. When she injured herself while skating and couldn't walk, her male compatriots even took turns carrying her to and from classes. And when she received her diploma from President McVeigh, newspapers across the state reported that prolonged applause greeted her. Esther soon became the first woman employed as a city engineer. Williston hired her after their current city engineer had been called into federal service. By the following year, the Williston Graphic reported, "Miss Esther Jack is getting along in fine shape as city engineer of Williston, despite the fact that it is probably the first time in North Dakota or in the Northwest that a woman has been appointed to such an office." Several years later, Esther Jack would also present and preside over the opening sessions of the State Convention of Engineers. In 1921, the Sioux County Pioneer noted that Jack, the only woman city engineer in the United States, resigned to pursue other career interests. She eventually became the deputy county superintendent for Williams County. After a move to California, she returned to North Dakota, where she served on the draft board with her mother during World War II. Esther lived a full life of prominence and firsts. She passed away in 1957, never marrying after her fiancé died during World War II, but she had opened many pathways for herself and for other women. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
President Trump's base largely supported his policy of separating children from migrant families at the border. But now the president is putting a stop to that.
I signed an executive order. We're going to keep families together, but the border is going to be just as tough as it's been.
We'll examine how President Trump's base is responding to his new policy. That's on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we'll hear from Dr. Donald Warren, the new director of the Indians into Medicine program at the UND School of Medicine and Health Sciences. And every Friday, News Director Dave Thompson joins us to talk about the stories that have been making headlines. And movie reviewer Matt Olin checks in. On Friday, he'll give us his opinion of First Reformed. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.